Hello, welcome to Growing Wild on Radio Reverb. I'm Charlotte Pett, and on this show, we go out camping onto the hills of the South Downs with author and adventurer Phoebe Smith. I have a little chat with the wondrous John Wright of River Cottage fame, known for his foraging, but we have a little chat about hedges. And then we're going to just check in with a few projects across the city at the end of the show to see what's happening in our community gardens. But first, let's have a song. And this is Rudy by The Specials. Message to you, Rudy by The Specials. I love that song. Okay, so this next bit, I have been trying to get this to happen since the show started. So, you know, about 6 months ago, I think I emailed Phoebe and wanted to set this up. And finally, in November, we managed to make it happen. Now, you wouldn't normally think of November potentially as a month to go out while camping, but, well, that just means you're not hardy enough. And it's completely possible as long as you've got a warm enough sleeping bag. Or is it? I guess you'll find out. Phoebe is she's an author. She's written books such as Wild Camping, Extreme Sleeps and The Bothy. And she's also the editor of a magazine called Wanderlust. And just a general outdoorsy kind of lass. And just a huge advocate of getting outside. And so I was very keen to meet her and to have this little adventure with her to show you actually how easy it is to do this kind of thing and how much fun it is to do this kind of thing. And so this is us heading out into Kingly Vale, where some of the oldest yew trees in Europe are, and they are completely beautiful, about 500 years old. So this is us heading off on our little adventure. I'm just walking up this quite steep ascent. We've just reached the yew. I'm just walking up this quite steep ascent, and we've just reached the yew trees, the ancient yew trees, and it looks a lot darker in there.
It looks really dark.
But you turn around and you've got this open expanse, a beautiful valley with just the last of the autumn colours, and a sunset brewing on the hill over there. And we're trying to find our spot to sleep tonight. What do you look for when you try and find where you're going to sleep that night?
Well, I always look for somewhere off the path, so that no one stumbles across me if they're dog walking late or jogging or whatever in the morning. And then I guess because we're going to try out hammocks, we're looking for two suitably strong trees that we can lash our hammocks up to. Yeah, I mean, normally if I'm wild camping out, I look for a view, but the offer to sleep among these oldest trees in Britain is too good an opportunity to miss, so yeah. Let's see if we can find them.
Ooh, it's like walking into a fairy tale. Blimey, it's so dark.
You could almost use a head torch already.
Yeah, and it's about 3:30, 4 maybe.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to have to kind of duck and dive under so many branches. It just wasn't what I was expecting.
It's quite nice though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I like it that it's presenting a challenge. I don't like it to come too easy.
It's proper wild.
Ah, well, these might work here.
Yeah.
There's a few branches sort of that might get in the way while we're tying it, but I think when we're hanging down, we should be all right.
Yeah, so we don't really want anything that might possibly land on our heads
at night. Can't promise that won't happen.
Yeah, that's a good distance away, isn't it?
And yeah, that's the ideal distance.
They're not too busy, these trunks.
No, so we could try there.
Yeah, that's one spot.
Easy to find.
I just need another one.
Maybe let's try this way just a little bit.
That's nice and open.
Yeah, should we head over that way?
Yeah. It's not that easy, is it?
It's really not that easy.
Mainly because I guess they're just not, they've let them just go feral,
yeah.
The trees, so they're growing.
Which is lovely.
Which is great.
So you're trying to
entirely not conducive to.
We could try going a little bit further up.
Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Let's see what happens. We're just. We've got hours, fine.
We'll just wander around.
Yeah. It's all good.
Bit thirsty.
Yeah, a bit hungry.
A bit hungry, a bit thirsty. Should have brought a snack. We've discovered a little nook.
It's just gorgeous.
Isn't
perfect,
it?
Actually.
Where it's just it's less dense, and you've just got the view peeping through the trees, and it's gorgeous. You can see over to the Isle of Wight, and well, it's a sea view.
And there's some flat ground here, which would be good in the morning. We could easily put one here. And then maybe either one there or one there. This could be quite nice, I think. It'll be certainly be easy to find when it goes dark.
I mean, I'm always up for being on top of the hill.
Yeah, well, let's do it.
All right.
Yeah, it's what it's all about. Yeah, no, that'd be perfect.
So when you're looking for a spot, do you kind of check in? Do you just take a minute and stand there and kind of see how it feels?
Oh, yeah.
Tune in to the environment.
I think a lot of it is instinct.
Yeah.
You know, people often say about being scared or feeling safe, and I do think you should really trust your instincts. I think when you're in the wilder places or in natural spots, you will become more attuned to your instincts, and for me it's always served me well. So if I feel good about a place, I'm going to sleep better.
Yeah.
And I want to sleep better so that I can wake up refreshed and go and explore some more.
Have you ever gone against that and slept somewhere where you weren't too sure and, you know, how did that go?
Well, I've slept in places I wasn't particularly keen on sleeping.
Right.
Just because night's fallen too quick, I've gotten too tired, and there is no choice. And obviously when I did something that I called the Extreme Sleeps Challenge, where I set myself the challenge to sleep by myself at all the extreme points of mainland Britain, so the highest, the lowest, wow. Northern, southern, eastern and westernmost points. And obviously you have to sleep, when you set yourself that challenge, you have to sleep where they actually are. And the easternmost is in a place called Lowestoft Ness in Suffolk. And it's a lovely spot, but it's not so nice where it actually is, because the easternmost point sits in front of a bird's eye factory.
Oh.
So you can imagine the smell.
Fish fingers.
And then it also sits next to the UK's largest wind turbine. So you have that constant drone.
Right.
And then the only spot where I could put my bivy, because the weather was so bad, this was November into December when I could actually fit it into my life to do it, the waves were coming over the spot that I wanted to sleep, so I had to sort of nestle down between Birdseye Factory, Turbine and a septic interceptor. So it certainly was unforgettable, but I certainly didn't go there and go, yes! Yeah. But then equally on that same challenge, I went to the westernmost point, which is up in Scotland, on the Ardmurchan Peninsula. And everyone thinks that it's the spot where the lighthouse is, but it's actually a tiny little hillock, just sort of a couple of kilometres to the south of it. And I never would have visited it anyway, because I am the world's worst at being a bit of a hill snob and being like, oh, it's not high enough, why would I visit it? Oh, there's one there that's much bigger, I'll go there, I'll get a better view.
Right.
But this challenge made me go there. And I went there, and not only on the way was it just the beautiful views looking over to, I think it was the Isle of Mull that you could see. And I also stumbled across this beautiful little cove where I found the remains of an old farmhouse, like an old crofting house. And then from the little hillock itself, looking out to sea, it was pouring with rain when I got there, so really miserable. But then in the morning, waking up to the sunrise and being there on my own and no one there and thinking, wow, I'm the westernmost point Britain. Yeah. It was perfect. Yeah. So setting a little challenge like that can be a little bit silly, but it can take you to some amazing places and equally some not so amazing places.
Right. Yeah, but then I guess, is it sometimes having that contrast as well? I mean,
you have to have one to appreciate the other.
Do you find yourself trying to find more and more remote places or hard or colder places, or do you test yourself more, or do you just think, actually, this is just about being outside and I don't need to make myself more uncomfortable than I need be?
I'd say it depends what mood I'm in. I slept on top of Ben Nevis and it was covered in snow. On the way up the first time, I had to try it twice because the first night this freezing fog came in and I just had to call it and stop halfway because I just couldn't see anything, even with a head torch. But that was quite extreme. And then when I did sleep on the summit, it was in the emergency shelter because my tent got ripped. It was so windy. And that's like sleeping inside a fridge freezer. It's absolutely freezing.
Wow.
You know, the water's dripping on you. It's so cold. But there is something exciting about pushing yourself to that next, you know, pushing yourself out of your comfort zone to find something a little bit more extreme for you.
What does that bring out in you? What's the, you know, the buzz in doing that?
I think it's just, it's a confidence thing. I think you push it a little bit and then you think, oh my goodness, it's so hard. And then, you know, whether it's that you're cold or you're tired or you're just like, why am I doing this? And then in the morning you wake up and you're in this beautiful place and you're on your own and you've done it, you've survived it, and you're looking around and you think, no, I can do this.
Yeah.
Why did I ever doubt I could do this? Or that, you know, and it does give you that real buzz of like, wow, I can do that, I can do anything. And you know, I often tell people in my career, as it were, the more I've pushed myself in my wild camping at extreme sleeping, the more successful I've got in my work life. And I don't think that's a coincidence. Like when I was working on a book the other year about bothies, I was heading out to find some of the most remote ones. On the way to one, it had rained the whole day. It was such heavy rain and it made it quite cold, even though it wasn't quite the winter yet. And then right at the last minute, after this whole day of battling through the storm, this river was in spate and it was so high that it had knocked the footbridge out.
Oh.
But I could see the bothy so close. And I was just, I got blinkers. Like, you know how they say you get that summit fever? I got bothy blinkers. And I was like, I have to make it to that because inside it'll be warmer. I can light a fire because I had a fire log. I have to get there no matter what. I spent an hour trying to cross this river and then I just thought, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to try and cross it. And I got stuck right near the other side where I actually thought, I don't know if I can get myself out of it. But of course I did. I'm here today. because I ended up getting really angry with myself when I had pushed it that far. And I thought, what have I done? This is so stupid. And I'm always telling people, like, I don't take unnecessary risks. And and then here I am doing this, and I'm on my own in the middle of nowhere, and this will be it. And then I just got so angry that I found it in me to kind of heave myself out of this ice-cold water. And then, you know, almost instantly, I started to think, oh my God, I came out of that.
Yes.
And I did it. And then you're like, things will go wrong. And things will go wrong when you're out in the outdoors. Things will go wrong in your everyday life, but it's not how the things go wrong, it's how you cope with the things going wrong. And if you can get yourself out of that, you go back and you go into work and someone gives you a ridiculously short deadline or someone gives you a bit of stick and you're just like, I've dealt with so much worse than that. I'm not going to let this define me.
Yeah. Do you think one of the biggest enemies is actually our own imagination as opposed to the reality of what is around? I mean, how many times have you actually encountered something
dangerous? I think it's totally that. The first time that I did this, I was convinced there was someone outside the tent. I told everyone who said someone's going to attack you in your tent. First time I went solo wild camping. And I said, don't be ridiculous, there's no one there. But then, of course, when you hear that first noise, the first time you're doing it, you're like, oh my God, there's an axe murderer outside my tent, and they're coming to kill me. And then you open the tent flap finally after forcing yourself to do it. And of course, it's just a rabbit or a sheep. Yeah. And you go, actually, that was pretty silly because, you know, if someone did want to attack you, why would they be lurking in the wilderness hoping you'd go rather than, you know, hanging out in a city centre where everyone's drinking and not really in control of their senses? Who's probably more likely going to get themselves in trouble? So, I definitely think it's one of those things. I mean, we're told stories as children, aren't we? You know, don't go into the woods and be afraid of the dark and, you know.
What do you think that is with our propensity to tell stories like that, especially to kids? You know, these fairy tales of who went down to the woods today and all of that stuff. Why do we instill ourselves with so much fear?
There's legends everywhere in wild places. There's a thing called the cool snag, which is in Rannoch Moor in Scotland. So they used to tell kids that if you went into the moors, this cool snag, if you found it and it saw you, you'd die instantly. And they used to tell kids this. But of course, Rannoch Moor is literally a massive bog on a grand scale. And bogs are really dangerous, even to grown-ups who know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So of course, if you imagine if a kid went out into very boggy land and, you know, there was no one there to help them, they literally could die. So I think, yes, they made the legends up to scare people, but actually they did have a reason. You don't want your kid running off into somewhere potentially dangerous.
Yeah. I guess the balance back then, though, was that we just lived outside so much more.
Exactly. But you know, people gone outdoors a lot, so it was just where it wasn't safe.
Yeah. As opposed to it being kind of everywhere now. Like, not many people would walk out here in the dark.
No, and people just sort of think, oh, outdoors, it's scary. Whether they think it's because it's too cold or there's evil people lurking there. And it's shocking when you read the stats that say how little kids today are not spending any time outside. You know, they're and almost sometimes the parents are encouraging that because they are worried.
Yeah.
But I remember, you know, you'd go and play with your friends outdoors and you wouldn't come back till it was time to eat.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah,
it was all part of the fun. You know, I grew up with a bit of woods behind my house, and we would tell each other ghost stories about things going on, but we would still hang out there until it got dark, and then, you know, then we'd head off home, and we'd always say, "Oh, we're going to build a den in our woods," and we'd get, you know, and it was so much more. You know, people just did it. So it is sad when you think people aren't engaging with it. And for me, the real danger with that is that if we don't encourage kids to fall in love with the outdoors and become sort of
just slipping around all over the place.
Yeah, if we don't encourage kids to fall in love with the outdoors and become ambassadors for protecting the outdoors, then, you know, when governments are looking to cut costs and sell off woodland, as we've seen before, you know, the Lake District has sold off some of its lakes, even one of its fells. Obviously, they've got a lot of restriction on it. No one can build on them. But, you know, is that the start of something more? And if not enough people are growing up seeing the value of an outdoor space, then who's going to protect them?
We're nearly back to the cars, having found our spot. And the night sky, although it's cloudy, it's got quite an orange hue about it. It's very light, so we're not using head torches, which is always the nicer way. It takes about, 45 minutes to get night vision?
Yeah.
And we're going to head off we're cheating a little bit and going to a pub for dinner.
Well, when you camp somewhere so easily accessible to pubs, it just seems foolish not to go and take advantage of some central heating and a hot meal, especially in November. I'm all for it. I always say enjoy, not endure, and that's definitely what we're going to do tonight.
And that was was us heading off to the pub as just as the rain started pouring down. You heard it right there at the end on the roof of my van. So I'm going to come back to that later and you can find out how we got on later on in the show. Next up, we've got John Wright. I've got a lovely interview with him coming up. But first, let's play a song and then we'll get to the bit I know everyone's been waiting for. It's about hedges.
On the first part of the journey, I was looking at all the life. There were plants and birds and rocks and things. There were sand and hills and rain. The first thing I met was a fly with a buzz and the sky with no clouds. The heat was hot and the ground was dry, but the air was full of sound. I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can't remember your name, because there ain't no one.
America and a horse with no name. Okay, so to John Wright, he is best known for his foraging antics with River Cottage, you know, old Hugh Fernley Whittingstall and the gang. He's written a whole series of handbooks for them about all the different things you can find in different locations, so seaside foraging and mushroom foraging and hedgerows. But most recently, he's written a book called The Natural History of the Hedgerow. And this is a really nice book. It's one of those books that looks nice on your table and then feels nice when you open it, and then you read it and you get filled up with knowledge that you didn't even know that you needed. It's an ideal accompaniment to one's life. I read this book and got quite taken with it. And so I asked him, what can we find in a hedge?
Well, people walk along a hedge and they'll see some trees. They'll say hawthorn, blackthorn, hazel, and they may see a few plants. Well, that's it. That's assuming they look at the hedge at all, which people tend not to. There's a sort of green backdrop to a walk, I suppose. But what really matters is slowing down and looking carefully and looking at everything and pondering things. I'm a very slow walker along hedges, and I sort of tend to ponder just about everything, examine everything. Mm. My daughter Lily says the only safe time to go for a walk with me is during night and dark, because then we get somewhere and she doesn't have to listen to constant lectures about this this particular fungus or this particular gall. But that's the sort of thing I find interesting. Mm. If you look, it's not a simple thing. If you find an elder tree in a hedge, and you often do, and you get a bit that's fallen down, underneath it's often white. It looks like someone's painted it with whitewash, and that's elder whitewash, which is a fungus. And that's interesting. That's really common. And you can impress all your friends by saying, oh, it's elder whitewash, it's fungus, don't you know, under this. And it's great.
I'm with John on that one. That is the kind of thing I do say to my friends about impressing them with various funguses in hedges. I then went on to ask him, what actually is a hedge?
It's quite difficult to actually work out what hedges are for, and I actually pondered it for a long time. As you say, we see them absolutely everywhere, and you think, well, what are they for? It's kind of obvious, but then you try and think about it, and it isn't. In fact, there's several reasons for having a hedge. It's a primary one. It's stock control. You need a hedge around your herd to keep your herd in one place, and also to keep all the nasty things out. Well, of course, there were wolves once upon a time. Stock control is the most important thing. Protection of stock is the other thing. Protection of the soil, so you don't, if you have a ploughed field, it doesn't get washed away or blown away in dry weather. It eliminates.
It's a tricky word. Though.
That's a terrible word. That's not a word, is it? It delimits. it delimits ownership. So it's really important. We're a very territorial species, and we like to know which is our patch. There are various other reasons for having hedges, but there's one reason for having a hedge now, which for the most part was not thought of by the people who created them in the first place, and that is a reservoir for nature.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to come to that, the habitat of a hedgerow, but I'm quite interested in who first brought in the hedges, because we just have these lovely vast, we would have these huge vast expanses of land, and it's quite a fairly recent thing, relatively to the human history, that we've started sort of getting territorial about our patch and our growing patch, because before that it was just land, wasn't it? So where in our human history did we start thinking, actually, this bit's mine and I'm going to build this barrier around it?
As soon as we stopped moving around, so we're really talking about the Neolithic people, they were the Mesolithic people were nomadic, certainly in Britain, and indeed early Neolithic people were too. So we're going back several thousand years before we started to put down roots. In my part of the world, we get really quite ancient hedges, and certainly signs of ancient hedges. There's a wonderful place in my part of West Dorset, not far from Chesil Beach, which is the Valley of Stones. And okay, it's got some stones at the bottom, but it's this wonderful rolling downland. And if you get the light just right, and if you don't, they're quite prominent, you can see a Bronze Age, what is believed to be a Bronze Age field system.
Wow.
About 50 fields visible. They're quite small. They're once called Celtic fields, but they predate the Celts. It's a wonderful little patchwork of fields. There's no hedges there now, but the banks are there. So they've been around a very long time.
Golly. In writing the book, did you get to sort of fly around and see these things from an aerial view, or have you done it mainly from photographs and things like that were already existing? Was it a mixture?
It's such a magnificent sight. I expect we've all had the experience of flying back, or most of us have had the experience of flying back from Crete or Tunisia or somewhere like that. And really the dominant feature of Britain, certainly England and Wales, is its fields and hedges.
It is a familiar sight, isn't it, when you fly back into the country? Just, you get that song, you know, Jerusalem. I played it out on another show a few months ago, and otherwise I think I probably would have played it again because it's so evocative of that when you fly over the country. Yeah, it's quite interesting with beginning to divvy up the land, and it really started to kick in sort of when the Enclosures Act came in the 15th, 16th century, and people were really like, well, how do we own land? How is this even a thing? How can we divvy up something that is its own living being? And that's kind of something that I really feel today. It feels really odd that we can just own land. I mean, it's its own entity. But there we go, we planted some hedges and we said, that's mine. And finally, what I went on to ask John was just a little bit more about what we actually can find in the hedges and just the amount of different plants. I think there's about a third of British plant life that can be found in a hedge, and the different creatures, microorganisms even, that live in our hedgerows.
I met up with a wonderful chap called Dr. Rob Walton and went down to his to his house in Devon and just north of Dartmoor. And he'd done a survey of a hedge in front of his garden. I think it was 70 metres long, 90 metres long, something like that. And over a two-year period, and still counting, there's bottles and bottles of things that are still waiting in the Natural History Museum. He found 2,070 species in a hedge. I mean, this is animals,
wow,
plants and fungi,
wow,
which is an awful lot.
Yes.
I mean, it was a very good hedge. You know, it had a ditch and it was a big hedge. It was a Devon hedge. It had a bank and two rows of slightly overgrown trees. I would think there could easily be 3,000 species there, maybe 4,000 species. And he wasn't, he got about 100 species of fungi. There will be more fungi in that length of hedge than 100 species. So, yeah, and it shows how important they are. What a hedgerow is, most of all, is a reservoir. It is a reservoir.
Okay.
And that is where we keep our natural history. Well, we tend to muck up everything else, which is rather sad, I think.
So what can we do? How can we, how can we help in this situation?
Oh, dear. Well, most of our land has gone for arable. So we grow crops. So everything gets ploughed up. Most fields are ploughed. Mm. Of course, most of the arable crops are, a lot of the arable crops are used in feed.
Yes.
So for feed for pigs and cattle and so on, which are kept in sheds. This is where the hypocrisy comes in, because I'm not a vegetarian. If we all went vegetarian, we could have an awful lot of our land back for natural history. It would take a few hundred years to get it looking good, but it would be worth it. I think you're going organic at least and making a much greater effort to buy my small quantities of meat from local producers. So that sort of thing really would help, but we'd all have to do it, or a large proportion of it.
Okay, so bringing it back, everything back down to a local scale, just because everything's done on such a huge scale now, isn't it? So really, the answer to so many things seems to be to bring it back down and make it more localised, especially in terms of biodiversity and actually effective ways of feeding ourselves. It seems to be about bringing it back down to a more local level.
We've been very used to having extremely cheap food. I can remember, I am sufficiently old to remember a time when chicken and indeed pork were sort of once a month treats, or chicken was actually barely once a month treat. But now we're used to buying stuff next to nothing.
Yeah, it's a big thing to reverse, isn't it? It's going to be a long.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen in a hurry, but every little bit does actually help.
It's a shame the end of that is slightly the tagline of a big supermarket, but the message remains: every bit does help. And it's really interesting that what he was saying was very, very similar to that of Dave Goulson, who was on a few shows back speaking about bees and what we can do to help them. So it's all the encouragement of wildlife and biodiversity always seems to be about reducing the scale of production. And over again, that crops up. So I'm wondering when we're actually all going to kick in and we're going to start listening to these things and start doing it. And I think going organic and and buying from local veg boxes and having meat much more rarely than we do now and making sure it's traceable meat, all of these things do actually really help. So if you want to know more about John and all of the books that he's written, and he's also makes all sorts of things to do with home brewing, he's got into that a lot, and using what's in our hedgerows to make really delicious drinks. But there's all of his information is on wild-food.net, but I'll stick the link on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. So we're going to have a song, and then we're going to head back out into the wilds and see how me and Phoebe got on our night out in our hammocks. But first of all, this is Presidents of the USA and Peaches.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Peaches come from a can. I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. Moving to the country, gonna eat a lot of peaches. I took a little nap with a loose old twist. Squished a rotten peach in my fist. And dreamed about you, a woman.
Rockier than I remember it being, but that was Peaches by Presidents of the USA, and the least said about that the better, I think, at the moment, that particular subject. Okay, so we're going to head back out with Phoebe Smith, and we had just been to the pub and had a delicious meal and sat there for a couple of hours and warmed our cockles, and listening to the rain outside and just checking to make sure it was going to pass as we'd heard that it would be. And thankfully it did. And this is us just getting out of our cars. So we have returned from the pub, which was so warm.
And so well timed.
And so I know that rain came literally as we got into the vehicles. And it has passed. And it's a beautiful, still night. It's not quite clear. It's a bit cloudy, but we've got some stars shining. It's quite bright still. Leftovers from the supermoon.
But it's cold if you can see your breath.
Yes, I can very much see my breath. Yeah, so we're going to make our way back up the hill to the spot we found earlier. Hopefully we can find it.
We'll find it.
It was these ones actually.
Yeah.
Maybe these and that?
Yeah.
Maybe here.
Make an L.
Let's see how we do. Oh, pooped after that hill.
You in?
For now, I'm in.
So we made it into our hammocks. We're both swinging in the trees. It's about 11:30. I think we're both feeling quite cocooned, quite warm. A bit worried about my feet. I'm feeling the breeze on those a little bit. It's a very still night. So let's see how we sleep. I think it's going to be all right. Night. Morning. How did you sleep?
Well, yeah, we didn't get the rain, so that was nice.
I'm so grateful because I did not put my tarp up.
Yeah, you're especially lucky. It was quite windy. The swaying is very natural. And I think the only part of me that got cold was my feet, but that's because I slipped down inside the hammock and my feet were sticking too far up. But other than that, oh yeah, amazing. And so many sounds of the wildlife, which was wonderful.
Yeah. I think, yeah, in woodland you just get a
definitely. And I love hearing it change from suddenly like so many owls to then in the morning it's more sort of the pheasants start moving and then you get the smaller birds and it's much more of a higher chirp. It is very primal. You go back to sort of like, oh, it must be about time to get up now. The bird song's changed.
Yeah. You just see the dawn creeping in through the trees as well. You just get this golden layer.
It's beautiful. Disappearing.
It's so lovely. And now we've got a nice hot cup of hot chocolate for our morning breakfast. So we've done one night out.
Yes.
In the wilds.
Yes.
And that felt, you know, I guess for some people that's challenging enough, but how many have you done in a row? You know, just continuing on and on and on.
Just purely walking from place to place has been 6 nights.
Okay.
And that's been up in Scotland, which is just kind of, it just lays itself out to do that in because when I did that particular trip, I was mixing, I had a tent with me. So some nights I'd be in a tent, there were bothies. So some nights I'd be in a bothy. So it was the summer. So some nights you could literally just lie out and look at the stars on your sleeping mat.
Yeah.
So and it's really funny because after you do even if just 3 nights feels very different because obviously you're carrying a lot more food with you is the thing. But you've got to make sure you've got enough gas for your stove because I always like to boil water to purify it. As the days go on, you don't really care that you're getting smelly or that, you know, you're not washing your pots as well, and you just and then when you get used to being on your own for that long, you come out, and I remember coming out into this tiny little village, and it suddenly felt like there were just hundreds of people. And of course there wasn't, there was maybe 40 people, but it suddenly felt really full on with people. I booked myself to stay in like a little B&B, and I went in there, and just everything that we take for granted suddenly just seemed like a real treat, like being able to flip a switch and have hot water from the kettle. Yeah. Turning a shower on and having like a hot shower just felt so amazing. But I think even just like you said, one night out, it can just remind people of that. It can remind people that, you know, the best things in life aren't things themselves. It's more experiences, and then it just kind of resets you a little bit to go back to your sort of normal life, living in a house, going to an office, and appreciating the little things a lot more.
Because you have got a full-time job.
So I'm the editor of a travel magazine called Wanderlust, and it's just a small independent magazine. And, you know, while I do get to travel a bit, a lot of my job is, like most other people's jobs, managing a team, sat in front of a computer screen for most of the day. And it's quite stressful. So I think for me, the going into the outdoors, it's a bit of a de-stress. Like, I probably have the best and longest night's sleep when I come out and sleep in a hammock or a bivvy or a tent. Because it does, you know, as we were talking about earlier, it does go very primal. You know, it starts to go dark and you get tired. And then in the morning, the sun's coming out. And in the winter, when that's not till past seven, but you're having a properly long sleep. And it is that reset. And sometimes that's all you need. Sometimes the one night is all you need. And waking up in the wild, as we have done now, having these beautiful views, seeing the sun come up, seeing the frost on the ground, you know, everything just feels somehow better and simpler. So I think I couldn't survive without doing this.
So we're all packed down, everything's on our backs.
It is.
So we make our merry descent back down this quite steep valley. And it's just really important to not leave any trace, isn't it?
No, absolutely. Everything at all should come out with you, and that includes toilet paper, which everyone hates the idea of. But and I'm a firm believer as well that if you see rubbish on the path you're walking or the place where you're sleeping, if you can carry it back, if you have enough room in your pack, do carry it back, because I think that litter breeds more litter. So anything we can do to make these wild places more beautiful and protect them, we should definitely be doing it.
What a beautiful morning. It's so nice to walk down in the sun, isn't it?
Hey, the cars are still there.
Yeah.
And now you can enjoy that you've done it.
That is always the last bit, just making sure that whatever you've arrived in is still there when you want to leave. But it was such a great experience doing that with Phoebe, and you know, going out in November and realizing that actually that's fine as long as you've got a good enough sleeping bag and some thermals. I do like sleeping in a thermal. But what you're saying at the end there is really important, that we chose not to have a fire despite the fact that it is November. And she's really quite keen on that, because we were in a nature reserve and we don't know what's going on in there, and when you see these little round patches of scorched land, we don't know what effect that's actually having on the biodiversity there. So I think just so cautious and just being respectful of your surroundings and not just slamming into them and putting your footprint on it too heavily is just really important in those experiences. If you want to find out more about Phoebe and read some of the books that she's written, basically she's just done little adventures like that, but gone way more extreme, like she was saying earlier, you know, sleeping on Ben Nevis and things like that. And then also just doing outings where she just pops out for a night. You know, she has a go bag that she keeps in her car. And so whenever the mood takes her, then she can just sleep out. And I think that's brilliant. I'm a huge fan of doing that. It just shakes up your day. The next day you already feel like you've achieved so much just by sleeping out. Her website is on the Growing Wild show page on radioreverb.com, so you can find her there. And so we also made a couple of videos about that, so I'll put the links up for that as well. And she just explains how to put up a hammock if you've not done that before. Yeah, so thank you, Phoebe, that was a lot of fun. Let's have a song, and then I just want to have a quick mention about a community garden that's got a Crowdstarter fund going that I think is really nice, and there's just a couple of days left on it, but let's have a song first.
Never thought that I was weak, always thought I could get hurt pretty bad, still get up on my own two feet. I always believed that I was free, some sense of integrity that would rise above whatever tried to change me. But honey, now I won't wait for something to bring me round and smile, 'cause that only sticks for a while, then I'm back. To be strong.
fortune or by sheer bad luck.
Gets fucked up, people just disappear.
So honey, now don't be mad. Thomas told me it can't be that bad, and if it is, well, I'll be goddamn, but I'll stick around. I'll be your master defender. Yeah, I'll stick.
Master Pretender by First Aid Kit. Okay, so the project I just want to mention is they're called the Friends of Dyke Road Community Garden, and they are hoping to raise money for a community orchard there. They've already got a community garden there and they want to create an orchard. So they have created a crowdfunder page and they're just looking for some donations. There's only 2 days left on it and they haven't got much more to raise, so if you feel like that might be something that you wanted to chuck some money at and invest in after everything we've said today, you know, about keeping things smaller and local and producing food much more closer to home, then this is such a nice project to get involved with. I'm going to put the link on the show page, but if you go to crowdfunder.co.uk and check out Dyke Road Park Community Orchard, then you'll probably find them there. And I know they'd really appreciate just a little bit of money to be able to get that project off the ground. Okay, well, we've come to the end of the show. So thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed it. And do check out, if you've been interested in anything I've said today, then all of the information is on Growing Wild on RadioReverb.com. And you can find me on Twitter or Instagram on Growing Wild FM with any questions, or if you can't find that information, then I'll happily pass it on to you. Next month, by the time I do the show next month, then it will have been Christmas already. So I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. It feels a little bit strange saying that in November, but I'll be back then, and I think we'll be going out tracking and game meats. I'd quite like to talk about that a bit more. And I'm going to play you out with Neil Young and Heart of Gold. Thanks for listening. Go well.
searching for a heart of gold, and I'm getting old. Keeps me searching. Searching for a heart of gold. You keep me searching.